Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and the Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rothberg. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report.
Hi, Edge. How are things?
Doing good, Jason. Thanks. So, you ready to start editing?
Always ready, thanks to New Monkey Studio, the ultimate recording facility.
Yep.
It's the first virtual studio I've ever worked with.
Well, we're not just virtual.
Of course you are. I'm in Ireland, you're in LA, we're recording.
Yes, this is true, but we are a full-service recording studio with some legendary gear.
Legendary? Wow, Edge, I think that's the most you've said to me since we started working together. What's this gear you're referring to?
Well, our mixing board was used by David Bowie, Rush, The Police. You know.
No way! I managed Andy Summers for a while.
Yep, he's in The Police.
Can anyone record at New Monkey?
Anyone? Sure. So, are you ready to edit?
Yeah, let's do that after, but tell us how we can find New Monkey Studio.
You can find us on Instagram at New Monkey Studio, and we have a website, newmonkeystudio.com.
You too can be cool like Edge and record with legendary gear in LA or from anywhere in the world at New Monkey Studio. That's newmonkeystudio.com. Ask for Edge. If you're a wine connoisseur, Carmen, if you like wine, Lisa is like teaching us the finer notes of Canadian wine. So,
okay, well, count me in.
I lived in Vancouver for 6 years.
Wait, Colin, do you know Canadian wine? None of us had ever heard of this. We didn't even know they made anything except for beer.
Yeah, we shot once upon a time in Vancouver. So I used to drink. Okanagan Valley wine all the time. That was my go-to.
Yes, right. Okanagan wine is the best.
Yeah, right on, for sure.
Lisa Collins very upset with you, by the way. He still has no socks and mug. I'm surprised he's talking to you right now. He says, I'm never talking to her again.
I know. I feel very badly.
So, sorry, Carmen. Yeah, for Christmas, Lisa Dunn, who you know is our lead researcher and script writer, she's just a genius. And an incredible musician, songwriter, singer. But she got these... The Sync Report mugs and socks, everyone's posting theirs. But of course, in Ireland, and I think my address might be flagged, but in Ireland, the mail internationally just kind of bottlenecks.
I was joking that all the mailmen stop at the local pub and then the mail never gets delivered. So I...
Completely.
For some reason, I sent them like Christmas time for Christmas gifts to everybody and they're still haven't arrived.
We're gonna have to send. We got to send. Colin's not buying it. We're gonna have to send Carmen some socks. He's in Prague, freezing his nuts off.
Carmen's gonna get his socks before I do.
He's in LA again now. He came back in January.
Oh, that's right. That's right. All right. He's not so cold.
Maybe I'll get them for my birthday next week.
Yeah, that's right. It's your birthday next week. Let's
hope.
Okay,
yes. I'll try to, like, I don't know. I'll parachute them in if I have to.
I'm glad you're here. So grab a drink. Let's have a conversation about music and sing. Oh,
I'd like to welcome our producer, Paula Flack. Hey, Paula, how are you? Can you tell us who's on the show today?
Colin, this week we have Carmen Rizzo on the show.
Woohoo!
Carmen is a two-time Grammy nominee, best known for his electronic world music. He has produced numerous albums for artists including Seal, Coldplay, Paul Oakenfold, Alanis Morissette, Dido, Jem, Khalid, A.R. Rahman, Ryuichi Sakamoto, Pete Townsend, Hun Her Too, and Niaz, among others.
Just a few names there, just a couple. Yeah.
Not name dropping. Carmen has composed music for Oscar-winning directors Michael Apted and Stanley Brooks and wrote the end title for Sony PlayStation's Uncharted 2. He's also served as a trustee and governor for the Recording Academy and created the categories Best Electronic Album and Technical Grammys for Apple and Roger Lynn, inventor of the drum machine. Amazing. Carmen participated in and hosted the HBO documentary The Song Story, which documents three unsigned music artists that he produced. He also has hosted and lectured masterclasses all over the world, including hosting his own TEDx talk in the US. He also runs his own music label, Electrophone Music, and spent 7 years as a senior artist relations manager at Native Instruments in North America. Let's give a warm welcome to Carmen Rizzo.
Carmen! Woo! Woo-hoo!
Hello.
Welcome, Carmen.
It's a very nice intro. Thank you. It's a very nice intro. I should add that I didn't produce all of those records, but I was on all of those records. And some I did produce, but all very good records that I'm very, very proud of.
It's incredible.
Amazing.
Incredible.
Well, welcome, Carmen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Carmen, there's so much to explore. This is such an incredible journey. You've actually been a friend of mine for 10, 15 years. I connected with you when I was working with the David Lynch Foundations and partners with David Lynch, and you contributed such amazing music. Since then, you've done remixes and helped with talent. I mean, there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but let's start back at the early moments of Carmen Rizzo. You know, obviously want to kind of talk about your musical influences as a child. What kind of music was playing in your home as you were growing up?
My parents were older than most of my other friends', parents. So they came from a different kind of generation. And so how they grew up was jazz and big band. So I was often listening to that in the household. My mother was a piano teacher. She was the music teacher at the school. So there was more of that kind of music than modern music, I would say.
You're growing up in San Francisco?
Yeah, I was growing up as a child in Connecticut. And then we moved to San Francisco Bay Area in the East Bay when I was in the fourth grade. So I'm quite old. So that was 1973. So I didn't move to Los Angeles till I was 19.
How do you go from the influence in the house to more commercial today music? I think we had mentioned during our pre-interview, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Elton John's incredible song was instrumental to you when you were growing up. Who turned you onto that track?
That was my neighbor and my best friend at the time, who unfortunately passed away as a teenager, but his name was actually Larry Hargadon. And so I would go to his house often. He was, I think, 2 years older than me. And his family was a little hipper and more progressive and modern. And I remember his sister bringing that Elton John record. And I was kind of blown away because it was hands-on, kind of changed what I was used to listening to. So that was a kind of a pivotal time in my life. But I wouldn't say that made me only listen to that music, but it was interesting because I was not into modern music then. So, but yeah.
I didn't actually realize there was such a heavy moment connected to your friend, Larry. The sentiment of that story, almost that worked perfectly. Like we planned that out. That was beautiful. Obviously your skills as a DJ, engineer and remixer, you deal with percussions day in and day out. And drums was the first instrument you picked up. You're self-taught. How did that unravel?
Well, my mother and my father were musicians, and my mother was a music teacher, like I said, and she was teaching piano. But I was fortunate that drums just was natural for me. And I was in a lot of bands as a really young kid and making county jazz bands and things like this. So that came natural to me and it was fun, but I really wanted to become a baseball player. So as I was growing up, I would go back and forth to music and to baseball. And then at some point I just said, I don't want to do music anymore. I want to do baseball. And so when I was in high school, I kind of faded out of music and more into baseball and went what I thought was pretty far. And I had hopes of being pro, but then I realized that just wasn't a reality.
Hey, but you still play, don't you? I mean, I see you and your son.
Yeah. Since COVID, I haven't because it, for lots of reasons, but yeah, I've been playing my whole adult life and like adult fastball, hard pitch baseball leagues, which is kind of pathetic, but really fun, of course. But now I do tennis, which is another conversation. But back to then, with sports, you know, the numbers don't lie and you think you're really good, then you make these really good teams and then everyone's really good. And then you don't play a lot, you know, you're on the bench quite a bit. And then when you get a chance to play, it's like, okay, this is your shot. So long story short, I ended my baseball passion as a young person and then went back to music. But I didn't really have the passion to be more of an artist or musician or this type. So I wanted to learn more about music from engineering and production and you know, mixing. So then I kind of went to a recording school in San Francisco. And I was probably the least likely to succeed because I didn't really know anything. And then I just moved to LA when I was 19 with $1,000.
Wow.
Why did you decide that it wasn't necessarily that you wanted to perform, let's say, you wanted to be more behind the scenes?
I don't know. Maybe I thought that it was something more responsible to do. Maybe I just wasn't strong enough because I think now, I mean, not to say people didn't do it then, but you have to understand this was, I graduated high school in 1982. All of my friends had a plan, allegedly. Mm. You know, their parents had money. They sent them to school. They ended up following their parents' path, most of them anyway. I didn't have that luxury to go to college money, and I didn't have the luxury to even really know what I wanted to do. So nowadays, someone can say, oh, I'm a great musician. I'm just going to become an artist. And you can, right? Now, but then it just wasn't on my radar. So I think looking back now, maybe I just said, well, at least if I learn some sort of production or engineering skill, I'll have a degree or there's maybe somewhat of a future, as opposed to like if I thought I was some badass, you know, as an artist or something, then maybe. But at the time, I definitely didn't, right?
Did you like performing in front of people? I'm guessing, I mean, if you wanted to be a pro baseball player, there was no fear of being in front of crowds. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
No, yeah. I don't think it was anything about fear of that sense. I think it was probably pressure looking back because, you know, here's a 19-year-old kid or whatever, 18-year-old, you know, graduating high school. What do I do? I didn't know what I wanted to do. So this was sort of a forced path to take, let's say. So it's just that I didn't really know. I didn't have a studio of my own. I didn't have gear. I didn't have the other edge that some of the other schoolmates had. So when I graduated, I without a doubt was the least likely to succeed. That's a fact.
This is Rose Carmen. Very nice to meet you.
Hi, Rose. Hello, nice to meet you.
There was an interview I saw that you had done. This is going back to your early influences, but you said something about loving vintage and not liking when technology is used as a crutch. So in your development to go behind the scenes in the music business, did you try to do as much as possible in a straightforward way rather than relying too much on the tricks, or you taught yourself first the old-fashioned way, and that probably served you better in the years that followed?
My mantra has always been, as far as I can remember, of not being a purist and really relying on technology, because I just feel that music making should be however organic you make it. And if you choose to do it a very traditional organic way, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
I personally do rely on technology for almost everything I do. And I'm kind of proud of that just because I'm not a purist. I don't care because I'm somebody of, I either like it or I don't. And I'm always interested in the process, but I'm not a purist, where often a lot of my friends are. Like, they'll judge you if you do it this way or don't do it that way, where I really don't care.
Right. As long as the end result is what you want.
Yeah. And I have to say, when I look back at my career, you know, everybody has that window you could reference from of, this was my break, or this is how I move forward. And without a doubt, technology has paved the road for me to have a career. I could give you many stories of knowing technology. And that's why I kind of call myself a technologist in a weird way, because it's allowed me to open the door to work with people.
But the technology was an acquired skill, because technology is developed.
Absolutely.
You know, from your first job, talk to us a little bit about your job at Westlake Studios and how that all came about and what you learned from.
I came to Los Angeles when I was 19. I had $1,000, right? I was lucky to get a job at Westlake Studios, but at the time, it was very difficult to get a second engineer jobs at studios. So you needed experience. And the only way you could get experience is that you'd have to be like a runner, right? Like a gopher, as they would call it. Yeah. So Westlake Studios had two locations, and they had a sales division as well. So there was a need for a runner. So I would, you know, show up at like 7 a.m. every morning, 5 days a week, and be the janitor from 7 to 9, like literally the janitor. And then I would just be the runner all day, you know, go get food, go do this, go do that. And then I took it upon myself for free to often stay at night. And I would wait until I had a chance to do something. Like, I would hang out in the shop where the techs would allowed me to learn how to solder cables and how they were aligning tape machines and things like this. And then if I were to get a shot in the studio, I would do that and learn, or sometimes even sleep there. You had to pay your dues. I mean, it's different.
Yeah.
It's really different. I don't want to sound like that old guy, but it really was different, because opportunities were just much different. Equipment was much different. I mean, now with technology being cheaper and you can make music on your phone or your laptop, et cetera. Back then, you know, like a reverb was $10,000, you know, I mean, compressors and obviously studios were expensive. So you didn't have that opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
Although I think having $1,000 at 19 was pretty good going. I'm not so sure I had $1,000 at 19, to be honest.
Well, that went pretty quick. Okay.
Yeah, I can imagine.
In LA, it would. Yeah.
Yeah. What was Native Instruments, Carmen?
So Native Instruments is a software hardware company for music makers, and it's a Berlin-based company. And they were kind of one of the first and most cutting edge at the time. They were started and founded approximately 1996 in Berlin. So they were making some of the first virtual instruments ever. They became very quickly, with the tools that they made, almost like the Swiss Army knife for all musicians, all, you know, music makers. So it was almost like everybody who made music used their product. And so I was one of the endorsed artists, and I came in one day for a meeting, and long story short, they were looking for someone to run the A&R department in America, and they asked me if I wanted it. And I said, I've never had a job before. You know, I've been an independent, you know, producer, musician, my whole life, engineer. So it was kind of timing, you know, I was going through a divorce, you know, I was heading that way, and they offered to me, and I was like, well, I'm very flattered that you trust me. So I said, why don't we try it and see if it works? And as long as I could sort of pause it occasionally to go make a record or do a show without pay, of course. And they were cool with that. So I did that for 7 years. I don't regret it. I had a wonderful time. I met some great people, formed some great relationships, and it was a fun job.
Amazing.
Carmen, it seems like as you're going from Westlake, I know you worked in a couple other studios as well after that, but it seems like when you met John Barnes, this amazing session musician, not only did you learn, but some amazing doors opened for you. Can you tell us how you met John and what that was like?
I'm trying to think how I actually met John. I'm going to guess that I was working at a studio that he took over on Melrose near La Cienega, off of, kind of on Melrose Place. And I believe that's how I might have met him. And then I quickly became his everyday full-time engineer, programmer kind of thing. And it was kind of love at first sight. We just became really great friends. I loved him and his family. He was one of the few people back then that really led the way of like a songwriter producer who had his own studio. Because back then, most people, if you were a musician, you were a hired gun, like he was, of course, but they didn't have like a facility in a studio, and they weren't also into technology. So John was just very instrumental in my life and my career because he was into technology. He was one of the first to have, you know, a Synclavier, a Fairlight. He had gear before anybody. He was also, at the time that I was, he was the only African-American in that sort of, you know, time that was doing so much in urban music for his own studio for other artists, which was, when I think back, so ahead of his time. And so the doors that opened is that we were meeting, I was meeting people through John. So I was meeting Michael Jackson, you know, all the Jacksons. I became friends with a lot of those people in that camp. That's what led me to work on the Bad album, which was kind of by accident, which I never got credit for. And it was so funny because it's a sore spot in my life, but I had to sign an NDA when I worked on that record and I never got credit in it. And I was looking for some paperwork yesterday and I found the NDA for Michael Jackson. It was really funny.
You found it. You still have it.
Yeah. I guess I never signed it, but yeah. Or I don't think I signed it. Or maybe I did. I don't remember, but that's another conversation about the Bad album, but yeah.
And obviously you're working with Quincy Jones and like a, like the who's who of the greats in the music industry at that time. And still to this day, sadly you didn't get credit, but working on Bad, that must have been a mind-blowing experience. Did you realize as you were in the middle of making that album, how big that would be?
Well, I had been to the Havenhurst house that Michael owned in the Valley with John, and I'd worked with Jermaine and I was familiar with the camp. And one day John said, "Hey, I have a session." It was like a weekend, I remember. And he says, "We have a session at Westlake, coincidentally, with Michael and Quincy. Do you want to come and set up the keyboards?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure. That'd be fun." So, and you have to remember, before Bruce Swedien and Quincy got involved with the Bad album, Bill Bottrell, who's a fantastic engineer, producer, writer, was John's kind of unofficial partner back then. They did a lot of records together. And they had written a lot of those songs and demoed a lot of those songs before Quincy got to it.
The songs on the Bad album?
Yeah, yeah. So they had no choice than to hire John and Bill. So I show up. He has all these beautiful analog keyboards. You can find it online on my website. There's a picture of that session with Michael.
Yeah.
And basically, I'm in the room and we're doing The Way You Make Me Feel, that song, you know? And so John just says, like, just stay. And so I'm just sitting there in the corner and it's just myself, John, Michael, Quincy, and Bruce, the engineer. And then Michael says, "Oh, we need hand claps on this song." And so John looks at me and says, "I mean, can you program the Lindrum, the Lind 9000? I'm like, "Sure." So I'm sitting there and Michael's telling me what he wants. And I'm just a part of the session. We eat together. And then, you know, this goes on all day into the evening. And then I leave and I had to sign something. And I never got credit. So I can't get a platinum record. And I've been trying to. They just don't budge.
Oh, no.
It's weird.
I know a company. I'm going to make one for you. Don't worry. You're going to have that.
Can I get one too?
Having worked with Michael and been around him, what do you feel is the biggest misinformation that has survived about Michael Jackson as an artist, or, you know, having been close to all of that, and of course, Quincy and everything, what do you feel, you know, what has come to be the Michael Jackson lore? What do you feel is something that people think, which really wasn't?
Well, I'm not sure I'm really educated to answer that question, because I, you know, I saw the documentary and, you know, we all read what people say.
But as an artist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously he's a talented person, and obviously my experience, you know, was on a creative level, you can't dispute his talent and his creative process.
Right.
You know, how he is behind closed doors, I have no experience, so I can't really comment. But I think hopefully people just would recognize him for his talent, you know, musically. I mean, the accusations, I just don't know. So I don't have an opinion. And it's just, it's a tragedy of the plastic surgery, because, you know, we're all told that because of his skin diseases and things like this, I personally think he just got carried away. But but I mean, musically, I think it's undisputed, right?
What we hear on the record, how much of that is Michael Jackson's input into, I guess, the orchestration of the tracks? How much of that was he involved with?
I think he's very involved. I mean, writing music is one thing, but dictating how a session goes is another thing. And I know John had a lot to do with that record, because he played on all of it, and you could hear his influence on that record. But, you know, I think Michael is definitely somebody who's very involved. He's not phoning that stuff in like some artists do, or some artists aren't involved. I mean, I think nowadays it's just much different. I mean, back then there was lots of musicians on records, because you had no choice, you know. Well, I guess you did have a choice, but you could hear it, as opposed to a lot of modern records. You know, there's like 10 writers on a song, and you hear the song, you're like, how is there 10 writers on this song? You know, it doesn't quite make sense. Where you could hear a Michael Jackson record with lots of musicians and orchestration, and you could hear other people on it, right?
I'm just interested, because it was the first concert I ever went to was the Bad concert. Lansdowne.
Oh, is that right?
1988, yeah. My dad took me, I was seven. My brother and I.
Oh, that's great.
I always wanted to have a little curl on the on my forehead, like Michael Jackson. <that age. laughs> But
that's
so
out of that concert, Colin.
I took the fact that he flew out of the concert on a jetpack.
Oh,
which
wow!
Was the thing I took away from it. Cool. But did you have some sort of connection with in the Prince camp? And what song would you say was the one that really made an impact on you, if you had to choose?
Yeah, he's my favorite artist, I think, ever. So. It's hard to pick one song, but I would say If I Was Your Girlfriend was one song that I just is one of my favorites of many. But my history with the camp stems from Susan Rogers, who was one of my mentors, who was Prince's main engineer for the prime of his career. Well, in my opinion, at the prime, kind of from Purple Rain through Sign of the Times, back to the Westlake, which was when I was the janitor and all that stuff. She was dating one of the techs named John Sacchetti, who was one of my best friends back then, and they were dating. So I met Susan, and Susan was working with Prince. And so I'll never forget this. You know, I was going down to the complex in West LA watching them film Purple Rain. And then, I was there at the filming. I can't believe I'm saying that. And then, you know, I was privy to go to all the parties and go to Minneapolis and go to see Purple Rain at the Forum. And Susan would invite me to like nightclubs back then, because, you know, they would work for like 5 days straight. Like she wouldn't leave the studio for like 4 days, 5 days, 3 days, whatever. And then they would make music, and they'd go over to Bernie Grumman Mastering, get test pressing a ref, and then they'd show up at a nightclub and she'd say, hey, come to Carlos and Charlie's or come to this place, we're gonna play this song. And then he would just see how the crowd would react. So I was privy to some of that. And then of course I knew Wendy and Lisa, who I ended up working with them a long time, and also Cat Glover, who was in Prince's. So it was just the whole history of the band. And
so Carmen, I've worked with so many great music composers and producers on like Trevor Horn, David Foster, Marius DeVries, and Rob Cavallo. And I'm actually working with Marius right now. How did you get to start working with these guys? And tell us a little bit about all of that.
Marius is a dear, dear friend, and he was Nellie Hooper's main keyboardist and programmer. Who Nellie is also English, and produced like Soul to Soul and Bjork, all those early kind of classics. And So I somehow met Marius. I don't even know how I met him actually, but he just left the Nellie camp, and so I ended up engineering and mixing and a lot of the records when he left there. And we did Robbie Robertson, which we had a Grammy nomination for. And then we just did a bunch of records. Then when he got into film, he was doing Baz Luhrmann's films, right? Like Romeo and Juliet, he had worked with all those films. And then he would just call me and say, "Hey, mate, I can't come to LA. Can you record Ozzy Osbourne for me?" You know, like, what? Moulin Rouge. I guess it was Moulin Rouge, yeah. I went down and recorded Ozzy for him, or Jessica Biel. He'd say, "Hey, can you work with Jessica Biel? I can't come into town." I'm like, "Yeah, okay." So we would do things like that. And then we just became super dear friends. And then, so Trevor, I met through Seal, of course. He was also one of my mentors. I learned an awful lot from him. And the Seal record we did, and projects, and we worked with Wendy and Lisa together. And he, you know, that stems from, you know, long time of doing music with him. And then David Foster, I was working with Beth Nielsen Chapman, and I had produced some of her music. And then there was a soundtrack that came up that I don't even know how they asked me, but basically David and I produced a track for the movie with Beth. And then Rob Cavallo, I met, I want to say through Jamie Mahobarak, who's one of my best friends, who's a huge session player in town. And then I became Rob's, you know, programmer on so many records. My God, like from the Tarzan soundtrack to Goo Goo Dolls and Alanis Morissette, all the movie stuff. And I mean, just countless records. We did so many records together. So yeah, I mean, when you're in LA and
you get into these circles.
And yeah, it's the LA hustle, you know. You're just, I mean, I was going through, like I said, when I was looking at these invoices and things, and I was actually looking for my high school diploma, if you can imagine that, which I couldn't find. I needed it for something and for this visa. And I was looking through, there was like a Queen invoice and like Miles Davis. Oh, I was like, I worked on a Queen record? I don't even remember that, you know. So,
I mean, do you feel that LA is the center of the music universe now, or has been?
It was
a long time.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I just think LA is the last frontier if you're looking for a hub. There's like beautiful little pockets all over the world that have an emerging music scene. But I think if you wanted one hub, I think LA is the last frontier because it has everything. You know, you've got musicians, you've got studios, you've got film and TV records, etc. Now, the negative, it's expensive, you know, but it's still a pretty big hub, right?
Right. I mean, I sit in New York City. So at one point in life, New York was important to the early music scene, but I have a feeling it's, you know, not as much anymore.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I mean, and again, I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I would say if one had to judge, I mean, okay, if you really look at numbers and statistics, you could probably put Nashville in the hottest seat because, but it's very specific musically and very specific how the hustle works there.
But at this time, what's crazy is here he is working like with the greatest, and I'm going to use the word pop for missing a better word for it, but like the greatest in music making and film making, very mainstream, but you seem to do like a severe left turn and head into world music. What generated that transition? Is this something that you always liked, was world music? Does that come from your mother and the early influences?
No, that was really an acquired taste because, you know, when you, and it kind of stems to Nashville when you asked about Nashville. Nashville, my experience at least, is it's very pop driven, which I don't gravitate, you know, musically. One, two, how they make records is like cookie cutter. Like, we're working 9 to 5 and you would take a lunch break at 12:01, and it's very competitive on the hustle. What happened was, I would say the turning point happened when I worked with Seal in the early 90s, which back then was a very eclectic record, and it was very successful. You know, that's the Seal 2 album that had, you know, Kiss Him a Rose, and I was lucky to have a few co-writes on that album.
Which isn't pop.
Which isn't pop, no. Well, I don't think it's pop because it's popular, but I guess that's open for discussion. I guess that proved to me that you could do eclectic music that, in my opinion, was very interesting and have success. At the same time, I did a record with Don Was called DD with an artist called Khaled, which was an Algerian Rai record that was, to this day, it's an anthem in Europe, especially in the Middle East community. And I got a ton of work in France. So I took it very seriously, and I had a lot of success in Europe, mainly in Paris, where I was doing this ethnic style music. And then the rest is kind of history, if you know my history, because then it sort of parlayed to other records like Ekova. And then I was working with Ryuichi Sakamoto. And then I worked with Hunter too. And I started a band called Niaz that I co-founded. And then it was La Marie and blah, blah, blah. And you could go down that rabbit hole. But then I realized that I was very good at sort of this electronic fusion of East meets West. And I felt that I was doing it very tastefully, and I was having success at it. So I enjoyed it. Then I just sort of said, I want to live in this lane of eclectic, either doing eclectic electronic music or eclectic world music. The globe is a big place. It's not just America. And that's kind of fast forwarding to where I am now. You know, I've come to peace with that, where with pop music, you're just always on the hustle to have hits and outdo the next person, which is so much out of your control. You know, you can do world music and ethnic or even a weird ambient music. It might not be super successful, but if it's good, it's super credible, and people bow down to you if they hear it. And that's more rewarding for me.
I'm getting a message in my ear. Our director, Kevin Sherpley, actually has a question for you.
Hey, Carmen. Nice to at least hear from you again.
Hello.
Yeah, you know each other. Actually, you guys have worked together before.
Yeah, Small that world, was on right? the musical tease. The musical tease. Yeah, we had a nice little trip from the airport to a venue in Palm Springs. And I was able to do a nice
That's
little
correct.
Interview with you.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And the timing might be right to release that interview again. But this has been so great to hear your musical journey. And with your music, you can hear that eclecticism. This, to me, is a great point. When you think about Seal's music, it's very eclectic. I don't really hear it as pop. And then hearing the evolution of where you have gotten to has been just this amalgamation of many different musical styles. So when you think about music and the reach of music and the world music that you do now, and the evolution even of electronic music, which is some of the, you know, the top music in the world, do you feel the balance of the reach of that kind of music is balanced with the type of exposure versus the type of money that comes with maybe the pop music?
Well, it's financially not very rewarding, I can say that. But I've really come to peace of measuring your success. It's like I often say, I'm fortunate. I've got, I don't know, 19 gold and platinum records on my wall, let's say, approximately. And somebody sees a record you did, or not even a gold or platinum, but they say, oh, you worked with this group or you worked on this album. They don't check your bank account. They don't ask you how much you got paid. No. They say you worked on this record or you did this. And that is what counts, because that's what gets you more work. It gets you the respect, et cetera. It's not some vanity project you did for somebody that was high paying, but nobody heard. So to me, I've come to peace with just being rewarded in different ways than just finance. And also with world music, it's allowed me to see the world. And if someone's known me for a while, you can easily figure out, you know, I'm fortunate to have traveled an awful lot of wonderful places that music has brought me to. And pop music would definitely not have done that. That alone is great, you know, to meet people from other countries, other cultures, other styles. And music has tied that together for me as opposed to pop music, which I just don't have that kind of history with, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing. So there is a balance there.
Yeah. It's not always a financial balance one wants to hear.
Well, really, you are a purist. I hate to say it. Just that response, you know, doesn't matter what you're using to make your music. You're making music to please the listener. And I think that is the advantage that you bring to every session, is that you're making, doesn't matter what it is, you're making something that is going to be special to a specific market, you know, whether it's the masses or not. And I love that about you.
Yeah, because in the end, you know, Jay, you have to play people music. You have to play people music. And again, they're not going to ask you the price tag. They either like it or they don't. So you have to make sure that whatever you're doing, you're proud of, you know, like record I'm doing currently with Danny Harrison, you know, when he called me and he was like fan of Hunt Her Too, that almost brought tears to my eyes, because here's somebody who I respect, who I love, who I know, and he's finding out a record that is very eclectic, extremely eclectic. And this is what you want. You want to be noticed for things like that. Not to say you shouldn't be embarrassed or you shouldn't be proud of, like, I don't know, a Britney Spears record you've done or something, but it's just different. It's just different.
That kind of brings me on to my next question, which is about Coldplay. How did all that come about, and how did you get the opportunity to work with Coldplay? And, or should I say, how did they get the opportunity to work with you?
Thank you for that, but that's the opposite. I was fortunate to be managed by Dave Holmes, their manager. So that's a really good story I'll make short, which is I was an artist signed to Network Records, and I had a band there called Povi Lu. And then I was also managed as a producer on Network. And so Network was a part of the EMI chain. And when Coldplay's first album came out, Parachutes, I think it was called, nobody wanted it in North America on the EMI chain. So Capitol, which was the home it should have been on, passed. So Network took it. Then Yellow became a hit. And then Capitol took it back. Mm. But at the time, Network assigned Dave Holmes, who was a junior manager, to Coldplay, who Coldplay had another management team. Capitol took the record back. Coldplay kept Dave. And then fast forward, Coldplay hired Dave as the sole manager. So now Dave is managing Coldplay and managing me. And then he says, hey, do you want to work with Chris Martin on this song, Speed of Sound? So I said, yeah. So Chris comes by my studio. We work. I help him finish this off. Was not a lot of work, but helped him finish it off. Was great. You know, went to the shows, this, that, and the other thing. But then where the story gets interesting is the remix, which is he says, hey, we need some remixes of Speed of Sound. Can you, you know, prepare? Since I was the only one who had the files, he's like, can you farm it out? They had farmed it out to some, I can't remember who, to do some club mixes. I'm like, yeah. Mm. I was like, I'll send it out. I'll do a mix myself. But I was at the time, I was like, I don't want to do an up-tempo. Everyone's going to be doing that. I want to do a down-tempo version because it's kind of what I'm known for. So I do a down-tempo version. I make the mistake of giving it to Jason Bentley first, who's a dear, dear friend of mine.
Great DJ, KCRW. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, who was like, you know, musical director at KCRW at the time. And also, well, he has a big show called Metropolis, which is like the big electronic show. And he also at the time had a big show on K-Rock, which is a big station here. So he plays the mix, unauthorized, And it's just off the chart. Like, it's just going, my people are finding my phone number. I'm like, who is this? Like, how did you get my phone number? Dave got a little bit upset and I had to tell Jason, you can't play it. So it was a bit complicated. It kind of backfired.
Oh, no.
But well, because it wasn't released. I mean, they should release it because it's out there. It's bootleg. It's, if you go to my SoundCloud, it's got like a zillion plays because people love it. So the point is, I'm really proud of it and it's really good. I think.
Do you think they didn't release it because you did that?
No, I think it was at the time it was panic mode. Like, take it down. Don't. I'm certain if I called Dave today or anyone, I could say, hey, why don't you release this? And they probably would, but it's just, I think it's kind of better as this folklore of like, it's in the, it still lives in the underground, which I kind of like, but let's see. Right. It's just fun. I'm very proud of it.
What's some of the best advice you've heard while working in the music business? You know, certainly for people who might be watching this, who are thinking of getting started in or have an interest in getting involved in, I know it's very different nowadays from when you first started, but what's some of the best advice you've heard?
It's ever changing. And I think it depends on everyone, but I guess if I had to generalize it, you know, there's something about being young and being fearless that you have to continue to have that urgency, because I see it in two ways. As one grows older, you lose the urgency and that fearless mindset because you might have more responsibilities. I also see it in young people who live at home or have rich parents or something. There's not that fearless thing in them. So that's something that I just think, do it while you're young and fearless. That's one thing. The second thing is, don't just assume you need a lot to make music. That's something where, when I think back of my early career, when I had less, making some of the best records, you know, where I had like a drum machine and a sampler and a controller. Nowadays, people just assume you need a lot to do a lot, but you don't. That's a myth. So those are two bits of advice. I also think, don't be ashamed of having a side job while you're pursuing music, because sure, we all want to have a full-time music career, but plenty of people do it on the side until you feel you can make a living. Some people are ashamed of that, and I don't think they should be.
The other thing is, of course, the lack of hunger. You know, I think a lot can be said for people when they're hungry as opposed to not hungry.
I'm so glad you actually said that, Rose, because as he's describing, you know, he starts off as a janitor and he's happy just to be there, to get the chance to work his way up.
Yeah.
I think we've lost that. This new generation expects like, oh, well, I'm on Spotify. Why
am
I
being handed to them?
Yeah.
I think people are used to instant, you know, gratification. I mean,
yeah.
I can tell you on the job market, a lot of these young people, they don't care of the growth potential. They want to get into a job. They want the title and the salary so they can go to the next job for the title and the salary, where I'm not interested in that. Like, you should be able to take your work home and own it. I mean, sure, there's a fine line. A lot of people don't care what they're selling or where they're working. They want the title. And I think that was part of the Native Instruments model that I, because somebody asked me that recently. It's funny you say that, but of what I didn't like there. And what I was seeing was them hiring people for like skill sets that didn't have anything to do with the product. So like, let's say maybe your marketing is from selling lawnmower blades or something. Well, how does that apply to music and tech? It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't always. And I think that people need to remind themselves of that. And I think the generation today, they want so much instant gratification that there is no urgency. There is no fearless mindset.
It really started in all of that. I taught graduate film at NYU for a while. And all of that really started with the dot-com boom and the Silicon Valley and Silicon Alley in New York thing, where like you could come up with one idea and then all of a sudden people were paying you millions of dollars, and people started conflating that with reality, which of course it wasn't. And when we saw the demise of that boom, you know, then there were a bunch of young people who never really held a job and lost all of their easy money. And then it's like, now what do I do? And that happened across the board, not just, you know, not just in the business world, but it really did affect artistic vision among young people who years before would have just been out there honing their craft and just fighting to get a foot of film to shoot something on the street. So
I think it
went across all of the creative landscape. But that brings me to my question about how you got involved in composition for film, how that weighs into your overall story.
That's a really short story because, you know, I don't really call myself a composer. I don't think I'm skilled, to be honest, but I've been fortunate to, you know, score a few short films. I mean, my big break was, you know, Michael Apted, may he rest in peace, but he was an Oscar-winning director, where a good friend of mine was the music supervisor, and she put me up for the gig, and it was between me and a very good friend of mine. And I went to them and I said, you know, this other person is a better choice. You know, he just came off of a cool, credible film and has more experience. They ended up hiring him, and then they ended up firing him, and then they called me and I got the gig. And so I was fortunate that that was a good break for me. I'm going to backtrack here because it's a pretty short a part of of the interview is this composing, because, you know, I had an agent with my dear friend Amos Newman at Gorfin Schwartz. Then he took me to William Morris. So I was lucky to do some small things, but to be a film composer, it's a full-time job. It's you got to put in so much work. I just wasn't committed. So, but I want to backpedal of when you asked me the advice to people, because it reminded me of the film, is it's important to, when you're talking to people for work, is to make sure people know if you're the right person or the wrong person. It's okay to turn something down. And I think that's important. You know, what you don't want to do is just take any gig and you find that you're the wrong person and then you get fired or it doesn't work out, where you should be strong enough to say, I'm the wrong person for this gig, or I really am the right person. So that's another bit of advice, that it's kind of tough love for young people to just remind themselves, I might not be the right person for this gig.
Yeah. One of the TV shows you did something for was True Blood. What did you do on that?
That was just licensing. My band is called Niaz. We were lucky that HBO licensed, I don't know, a handful of songs or something for various shows. So it was just licensing. I was lucky that some songs have been in some good shows.
Great show. Alan Ball. Yeah. Great group of people on that. Terrific. Yeah. Thank you, Carmen.
All these amazing names that we've been going through, your journey has just brought you to the doorsteps of like the greatest in our industry. But you're also so committed to working with the lesser known artists. How do you go about deciding what attracts you to an artist and makes you take that risk to work with somebody that might not be as known?
Well, thanks for, you know, even noticing that, because I pride myself on good music. I mean, you know, Melissa Lingo is a perfect kind of example where we found each other, or somebody turned me on to her music, and I didn't care. She was living in Cambodia at the time. Now she lives in Budapest, but I love good music and I'm willing to take a risk on someone and something if I believe in the music, because like I said earlier, it's the music that gets you the respect, it gets you the next gig, it's a part of your legacy. And I've been doing this long enough where the artists that I can reference of credibility, from, you know, Ryuichi Sakamoto to a Grantley Phillips, to, I could go down the long list of not even the big names like Pete Townsend, you know, all these people, they're credible and I can play it for anyone. And so I don't care, you know, I mean, music speaks for itself in the end, right? And at some point you have to take a chance. Someone took a chance on me and I'll take a chance on someone else.
That's fantastic. I wanted to ask you, Carmen, you've got some other new projects on the go at the moment, do you? I think I heard that you're working on a new album with Seal.
Yeah, Seal and I were dear, dear, dear friends. We play tennis all the time and he's doing new music. So he's working with a lot of other great people as well. And I've been lucky to work on some good stuff with him. When it's coming out, I don't know, but yes, I'm working with him on some stuff. working on another Melissa Lingo record at the moment. I'm working with Danny Harrison, which he's jumping on board of a new Hun Her 2 album. So I was in London twice this year working with him. I'm going back, I think, next month to work with him.
Are you working on any music of your own right now?
Yes. I have a Middle Eastern project called Didon, which I partnered with a woman named Miriam Benamor, who's this another just powerhouse of just also would put her in the top 5 or 6 people, just incredible. She's from Tunisia, and I made a record with her. And so after we did her record, we're doing a side project, just me and her, which is this great record. So yeah, so that's the kind of current project. There's also a young girl who's 19 called Karen Ann that I did some production on, who's from Slovakia, who's sort of like a Billie Eilish kind of pop. It's very good music, and I'm really proud of that stuff as well.
I wanted you and Rose to hear about all the charity work this man does, the leader he's been with the Grammy organization. There's just so many things that we can't even touch on because we just don't have the time to squeeze it into an hour conversation. But Carmen, thank you for joining us today. Your story is so amazingly cool. I find it inspiration. I know our audience is going to be completely blown away hearing you and these stories and realizing there is no ego with this man. It's all about the art. And I'm proud to say that you're a dear friend of mine, and I absolutely adore you, Carmen.
Well, thank you for the kind words, Jason. Really, I'm so grateful, and thank you for having me on the show. I hope I didn't bore too many people with my story.
They were wonderful. Thank you, Carmen.
It was amazing.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, I'm really glad that you're doing this. I hope people enjoy the conversation. So anything you guys need from me, just ask. I'm here for you. Well, thank you, everyone. I really appreciate it. So lots of love to everyone, and thank you again, and we'll speak soon.
Thank you so much to our amazingly talented guests for joining us on today's show, and to you, our listeners, for spending your time listening to us and being with us. The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, myself, Colin O'Donoghue, Rose Ganguza, and Jason P. Rothberg. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.